Support for Switched on Pop comes from Stereophonic, Broadway's must-experience new play. If you only see one thing on Broadway this year, make sure it's Stereophonic, written by David Adjmi, directed by Daniel Auchin, and featuring original music by Arcade Fire's Will Butler. The play follows a 1970s rock band on the verge of breaking down, breaking up, or breaking through. The New York Times, The New Yorker, and New York Magazine call it best of the year, and Peter Marks of The Washington Post says, okay, I'll go there. Stereophonic is the best play of the year. Get your tickets at stereophonicplay.com/fox.
To get that sort of activism in the song, it was, you know, like, what's the point of my lips if they don't make noise? So, like, an idea of, like, why have a voice if we aren't using it to speak out against injustice?
Welcome to Switched on Pop. I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
And I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
Today we're going to speak with Justin Tranter, one of the most prolific contemporary songwriters. Justin's written many of the songs we've broken down on the show. Justin Bieber's Sorry, Janelle Monáe's Make Me Feel, Selena Gomez's Bad Liar, and Julia Michaels' Issues, with who he collaborates frequently.
Yeah.
Justin is more than just a songwriter, though. He's also a prominent LGBT and gun safety activist. He serves on the board of GLAAD, and he uses his songwriting platform to advocate his politics and to boost marginalized voices. He's prolific, thoughtful, and instructive on how someone can embed their activism into their work. So, Nate, I think you're going to really enjoy this one. Here's our conversation with Justin. Justin, thank you for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
So, in your Twitter bio, you are songwriter, activist. And
yes.
Today I want to talk about both of those sides of your wonderful music. And I think what we're going to see is that they are inseparable.
Yes.
But let's jump in and talk about your music first, because that's what we always want to do on the show.
Sure.
You are coming today with a song that you've co-written with Dua Lipa called Swan Song. It's the end credit of Alita Battle Angel, and it serves as both a pop song and a film score.
Correct.
So let's...
Hopefully.
Yeah, we'll see.
So let's just dive right in and take a listen to that.
Okay, cool.
The flicker burning, you know the time is running, running out, only I see. Oh, the diamonds, diamonds breaking down. I won't stay quiet, I won't stay quiet, cause staying silent's the same as dying. I won't stay quiet, the flicker's burning now. This is not a, this is not a
That's fun.
Well, thank you.
So I just want to start and ask, what is a swan song?
Swan song is, I think, the end of someone's career. So,
right.
Or their final moments. Swan dive, swan song, it's like your yeah. final moment. For me, watching Alita, this is definitely a song 100% written for the movie. So I saw the movie first. I was a huge fan of the anime.
Mm.
And to me, it's just this... woman, cyborg, whatever we want to call this brilliant character of Alita, kind of comes into her powers and realizes through her history and through being true to herself that she has the power to change the world.
Yeah.
And so this is not her swan song.
Yeah.
This is not her swan dive. It's a new life.
So both you and Dua Lipa have gone on social media and talked a little bit more about some of the meaning behind this song. And she had said that This Is Not a Swan Song is about the fight for justice, and that it's not just the beginning of the fight for justice. This is an ongoing battle.
Exactly.
And so I was wondering in the songwriting process if there were bits of sort of intentional thoughts about how are we going to embed topics of justice within this song.
It was very intentional. So when I saw the movie, I was just so excited that I was like, wait, I get to like write a song, and like this character is an activist. Like,
right.
We don't think of it that way, but like superheroes are all activists. They're like fighting evil. They're fighting wrong. And in Alita, it's very much like the rich live in the sky city and the whole rest of the world, because the world's been destroyed. So the only people left are all dirt poor and live below the sky city.
Right.
To get that sort of activism in the song, it was, you know, like what's the point of my lips if they don't make noise? So like an idea of like, we all have a voice. what's the point? Like, why have a voice if we aren't using it to speak out against injustice? Alita has this insane power. She knows this martial art form that only, like, has died. No one knows it, but she knows it.
Yeah.
And she's this crazy cyborg that has, her body has this technology that other bodies don't, that other cyborg bodies don't.
Right.
So she is, has this extreme privilege. And as I always say, what's the point of privilege if you don't pay it forward? Mm. So to me, like, Alita's the ultimate privileged activist using her privilege for good. Huh. And then also we say in the pre-chorus, it's very much inspired by ACT UP, which was from the 80s, and it still exists today, but started in the 80s, HIV and AIDS activist group that ended up saving millions and millions of lives with their fight. And their motto was silence equals death.
Yeah.
And so that idea of, you know, staying quiet's the same as dying. So we're tried to find subtle ways to really infuse activist history into the song.
That's a beautiful moment. I want to take a second and just play the pre-chorus so people can hear
that. Sure.
Yeah, so I obviously seen many posters with silence equals dying and people protesting.
Yeah, silence equals death.
Silence equals death. Thank you. Yeah. What a fun and special moment to have that reference in there.
Again, who knows what's going to happen at radio, but right now it's like top 20, I think. So like to have a song that's for a movie, and a movie song getting on radio is very difficult to do because you have to serve the movie. You're not, that has to be your priority.
Right.
But the fact, and then the fact that we're referencing ACT UP in a pop song is pretty fucking awesome. And then for Dua to be so cool and really let people know what the song is about and where it's coming from, I think is even, to me, that makes me so proud that, you know, the best new artist just won the fucking Grammy for best new artist is talking about ACT UP.
Yeah.
My job is done. Like, I can quit. That makes me feel really good.
And so often people might want to be precious about their lyrics, and or not even being precious, but may want to say, hey, why don't you just hear what you want to hear in it? But I think it's even that much more powerful that you all are saying here, no, here's what's actually going on.
Yeah. Thank you. It makes, to me, it's one of my proudest moments.
So I heard some other moments for me that had that sort of call for social justice within the music, and I wanted to play some of those clips and see if those are, you know, were those songwriting choices? How did those come about? So the first thing that we heard was actually in the very beginning of the song, in the intro, which we didn't play yet. So I want to play that clip really quickly.
Cool.
So here we're getting this like rousing battle cry. There's this percussion that is almost like warlike, and you can feel like people are like going out to march or something. Yeah. You can hear people sort of chanting something in the background.
When you're writing for a movie and you're writing the end title, like, you have to have that transition in mind.
Right.
Which is such, again, as I said, that's my first time. I've written songs for movies before, but never like the song. You know what I mean? It's like you're writing for a scene, or, you know, I did Lego Batman, I did Instant Family, but like, it was end title, it's a much different thing, right? You have to try to embody the movie, and you think about those transitions, and
That first note, I mean, you get the dun 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 dun,
which is from the score,
grabs you. It's a hook in and of itself, and then the rallying cry, and it's a perfect transition. Sort of screen goes blank, boom, and the music continues the narrative.
Yeah, I worked very hard for this opportunity and for this whole process, from the music supervisor, Dave Jordan, who was unbelievable to work with, to then Dave Jordan introducing me to Junkie XL, which was a dream come true.
Yeah. And who soundtracked the film.
He did the score, and we sampled a piece of his score.
That's what I was wondering about, that, because those strings are so beautiful.
Yeah.
They sound like real strings, but they're chopped off.
At the end, it's all from his score. So we sampled a couple moments from his score, Mattman and Robin did, so that it really, really, when you watch the movie and then it plays, it's like a whole other level of magic. And then, you know, definitely had to play the balance of trying to create something that can live in the pop world, but really serves the movie. It was a whole other process that I've never been through before.
Yeah.
Right. So it has to make sense in the context of the movie and then be able to be removed from that into the wider world of pop.
100%.
That is tough.
So I imagine, obviously, referencing the score is helpful, but also its orchestral qualities give it both a score-like sound as well as a pop sound.
And
because I feel like those samples from the orchestra almost have like a trap aesthetic. Like, you hear those same kind of orchestral hits.
Yeah, never thought of that, but you're right. Yeah.
you can hear this on the radio and it works, or you can watch it in the film and it works.
Yeah. We wanted to definitely make it feel like from the get-go that it continues the thought and that feeling of Alita just winning Motorball and like staring up at the sky being like, you know, I'm coming for all of you.
Interesting.
Which is a quote from Battlestar, in case anyone was.
Nice. Really?
It's President Rosalyn says it. She says, fuck, what is it? Like, I'll use every bomb, every weapon down to my eye teeth. I'm coming for all of you.
You're really showcasing your sci-fi credentials
it's
here.
It's there. Yeah. It's very serious.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's what's so interesting about this song, right? It's always working on two levels. It's working on that dramatic movie level, and then it's working on that just like, I can listen to this as a pop song not knowing the context of this at all and enjoy it.
I think it would be incomplete to talk about its role as a pop song without diving into the chorus.
Let's do it.
Nice.
So even here in the chorus, I'm hearing this continual call for a fight for justice. And one of the ways that I think maybe even Nate, you first noted was the declamation changes. The declamation being a fancy word for the pacing of the words.
Yes.
And
I was like, I have a degree in songwriting and I don't even know what declamation is.
Our motto is like, never use a simple word when a more complex one would work on this show.
I mean, it seems to be working for you.
I want to apologize for my pretense. But we go from this pre-chorus where things are getting faster, won't stay quiet, silence is the same as dying, and then all of a sudden, this is not a.
Yeah.
Swan. Song.
Yeah.
It's such a dramatic shift.
It's dramatic as fuck. Yeah, I mean, I love drama, one, and two, on purpose, we definitely have the track feel a little more minimal. Of course, you have the big string hits, but then besides that, the track's pretty minimal there on purpose so that it can at least try to exist in pop realm. Mm-hmm. It is very dramatic and odd for a pop song.
Yeah.
Because again, the main purpose is to serve the movie. But one of the ideas and one of the conversations I did have with all the filmmakers was like, we got to pull back on the chorus a little bit if we want it to exist in the current pop landscape. Sadly, we're not in a My Heart Will Go On era right now. wish we fucking were. Let's, you know, maybe I'll try, but...
It's a powerful moment. It actually reminds me a little bit of like what happens in Charlie Puth's Attention, where the song is sort of like building, and then
you pull
back.
Yeah. And now I'm all upon you, what you expect, but you're not coming home with me tonight. You just want attention.
But here it works so well because it feels like, again, a sort of a call to arms.
Yeah,
and
for
this
sure.
is something that I want to chant along to. It has that like stadium anthem quality that it's just the voice, more or less.
Yeah, 100%. Well, thank you. That's what we were going for. And then also, too, we're always thinking about highlighting the different sections of the songs by making sure there are rhythmic changes and making sure that melodies start in different parts of the phrase.
Right.
And that's things that we talk about quite frequently. So whether it's a song for a movie or whether you're trying to create a call for action or whatever it is, no matter what it is, we are having the conversations about the rhythmic changes, the melodic changes, the changes in the phrasing, the changes in the pacing to make sure that each section complements each other and then that the chorus can really shine.
One moment I think is really effective in that respect is that phrase, swan song, because you might expect it to come in on the downbeat of the measure where it would go, this is not a swan song or something like that.
Yeah.
But instead it doesn't. You wait for a moment. That first downbeat is just empty. This is not a space. And then swan.
Right.
It's very hooky at the same time, but it's also like slightly surprising.
Yeah. I do also just, I love, you know, screaming on the two of a chorus.
Yeah.
It's worked for me before, it'll work again.
Nice. That's great. We should have like a wall of songwriting, you know, maxims.
Yeah.
That'll go on there. Screaming on the two of the chorus.
I actually haven't even thought about it until now, but yeah, like pain, baby.
Oh yeah, Imagine Dragons, yeah. Totally.
You were a believer as well.
Co-wrote.
Co-wrote, I mean, yes. Yeah, of course.
Dan Reynolds is one of the best writers in pop music, so I can't really.
That's super interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure that was his melody because he's fucking amazing. I can't take credit for it, but another song I was a part of that, you know, Scream on the Two.
Scream on the Two. Justin Scream on the Two Tranter.
I like maybe there's like some Illuminati just like go digging through all of Justin's songs. And is this your secret signature that we've been missing all
along? I think those
are
the only two big ones that do it, but I'm sure there's more.
Maybe for folks who aren't as familiar with songwriting, you're talking about the importance of creating these contrasting sections and sort of mixing up the rhythm, mixing up the melody. Hmm. When that's not done well, what is the effect?
The effect is, or I'll say like when like you're like, fuck, this like verse and this pre feels so good.
Yeah.
And then the chorus is a letdown. Normally, if you then you go and look at the, I hate to say the math of it because that takes away, people hear math and they think it's no longer an art form. But if you look at like the nuts and bolts of it, it's probably because the phrasing is starting on the same place as your pre-chorus does.
Yeah.
So that way it doesn't feel, your chorus isn't getting a lift. It doesn't feel any different because you're starting in the same spot or you're using too many of the same notes.
Right.
Like a piano is an easy way to look at it. Like you're playing the same three notes on the piano over and over.
Right.
Now it might be in a different rhythm or it might be in a different whatever, but if you're using those same three notes that you in the chorus that you're using in the pre or two notes or five notes, whatever, if you're in the same area, it's just not going to feel like a lift. But then there always are exceptions to those rules. You know, like Good For You, Selena Gomez, me and Julia were working on that. And as I've said many times, and I'm happy to say again, you know, Julia is definitely another one of those writers I work with where she's leading the way.
This is Julia Michaels.
Julia Michaels, I'm there to elevate and support, what she's doing. Wear that dress you like, skin tight, do my hair grow real nice, and sink up in my skin to how you're breathing. Cause I just wanna look good for you, good. With Good For You, the majority of the song does melodically exist in the same range. So as I was saying before, if your chorus isn't feeling good, that's probably why that the notes are in the same range, but there are exceptions to that where it will work. But if you look at the rhythms of Good For You, it's the rhythms that are making it good for you. When you have that hooky rhythm, you can get away with the fact that the notes are kind of in the same range. And it really lets you put a super focus on Selena's amazing vocal tone and on our really fucking weird lyrics in that song. So that's again another on purpose of like, if you want the listener to get through a really, really weird lyric, it can kind of help you to have the melodic range be in the same spot.
Each song kind of has its own logic.
Its own set of rules. Yeah, but, and kind of the math of it all is only used when we run into a problem. Mm. When like the natural flow of what came out, it's like, fuck, that verse is so good, but everything else isn't working. Why isn't it working? Let's look at it.
Math
time with Justin Tranter.
Which, I mean, when it comes to actual math, I'm the last person you should ever talk to.
So you actually just made me realize one of my favorite lyrics in Good For You is connected to that rhythmic vocal quality in the chorus. There's the lyric, I want to syncopate my skin to your breathing. Mm. I've never heard syncopate used that way.
Yeah.
And I thought,
and then the rhythms are syncopated.
Good. For you.
Syncopate my skin to your heart. Then that's the actual word is syncopated too.
Text painting.
Yeah.
Ching.
Yeah. Which is, if anyone's interested in the best text painter ever, Patty Larkin is the greatest at it in the whole world.
Patty Larkin. Whoa.
She's
that's
the
a
best.
Deep tip. Cool.
I would consider her like top five greatest songwriters. Yeah.
I want to evoke this idea of Swan Song. This is not the final battle.
Yes.
And use this as an opportunity to transition to talk more about how you embed your activism throughout other parts of both your life and your music.
Yeah.
And I wanted to start by asking, is the idea of queering pop music an important part of your mission?
Well, important part of my mission is to just be honest and to encourage everyone that I work with to be honest.
Yeah.
I think if I had to pick like my greatest skill as a collaborator, it is creating confidence in the room. And it is creating the artists that I work with and the writers that I work with to be brave enough to tell some very, very real truths. And so for me, anytime, you know, these songs are almost never about me.
Right.
I'm there to serve somebody else, which I never thought would be my favorite thing to do, but I fucking love it.
Yeah.
But it also, I didn't start writing for other people until I was about 33, 34. So
yeah.
That also, you're at an age where you're like, yeah,
I can,
like, this,
system, can,
this cannot be about me, and that's
right.
Okay. So even though the songs are about them, if I want to be a good collaborator and I want to contribute lyrics that feel real, I need to be thinking of my own life.
Right.
And my life is queer, you know, not to keep talking about Good For You randomly, but like
Good
For You is a great example where that Julia 100% led the way on that song. Mm-hmm. I'm there to elevate, focus, support, obviously co-write, but it was her idea that I was lucky enough to help.
Yeah. Mm.
And for me, I 100% when she brought up the idea, I was thinking about an ex-boyfriend of mine who like really, really, you know, if you Google me and you like Google Justin Tranter 2008, I looked really fabulous and crazy and insane. And my boyfriend at the time, like the more femme I looked, the more he loved that. Mm-hmm. And so for me, this idea of this song about, you know, getting all dressed up and blah, 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 the way that I was able to relate to it, to Julia's amazing idea and to contribute in an honest way was from a very, very queer perspective and a point of view and a very queer experience. Mm. So queering pop music, it's not like it's a specific mission, but the mission is to be honest.
Yeah.
And so if I'm working with a queer artist, it's to give them the confidence and the strength and to give their management and label the confidence and the strength that that not only is diversity an honest diversity, because obviously queer people, our diversity can be invisible if someone is straight passing or cis passing if it's a trans situation. That diversity and honesty not only is the right thing to do for culture and for society, but it actually, you know, I think it's finally in the movie business what's proving to make money. Yeah. Like, diversity fucking sells because people relate to honesty.
Hmm. Despite that, is there, because I think when some people think of pop music, they think of not honesty. They think of, you know, something very manufactured, something sort of corporate perhaps, and something perhaps even avoiding any sort of realness, real political engagement or something.
For sure.
Either like in your own experience or maybe just more conceptually, like, do you think about how to deliver that honesty in a way that is still pop or that is still like sellable or something?
Kind of. The only way I ever think about that is like in terms of the chorus. And it's not just about like political messages or queer messages or whatever it is. It's about any story you're trying to tell. You know, I think Taylor Swift is an amazing example of, you know, one of the best pop writers of our time. Even when she was writing country music, it was popular, so it's pop.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Which, of course, a lot of songwriters do. I just use Taylor as an example because she's amazing. And obviously,
we
all know a couple Taylor Swift songs. So
just a few.
Just a few hundred, yeah. Fearless is one of the best albums of all time. Okay, moving on. So
I'm with you.
Her verses would be so fucking specific.
Yeah.
And, like, I do not know what it's like to be a cis woman with a gajillion dollars, but she's so specific to her storytelling that I would always relate to every fucking second.
I'm really gonna miss you picking fights and me falling for it, screaming that I'm right. And you would hide away and find your peace of mind with some indie record that's much cooler than mine.
But then you get to the chorus, and it's a chorus that, of course, the lyrics are amazing, but they are general enough that we can all get on board.
Yeah.
If someone is telling a very specific story, whether it's queer or political or just about a relationship, a straight, normal, cis relationship, I always think, let's find a way that the chorus can really just sum up the whole story and be really easy to digest. And so I think about sometimes, like, verses are for the super fans and choruses are for everybody. You know what I mean?
That's
so, like,
great. Yeah.
So that's the only way I think about it. It's not in a way of, like, how do we, like, soften this message for the, to, like, slip it through. It's like, how do we make sure people can understand it in one listen?
Yeah.
Support for Switched on Pop comes from Stereophonic, Broadway's must experience new play. If you're anything like us, you're obsessed with music. Not just listening to it, but everything behind the scenes as well. What makes a good band? What makes a great song? And what does it take to make it big? All of these questions and more are explored in the remarkable new Broadway play, Stereophonic. The New York Times, The New Yorker, and New York Magazine call it best of the year, and Peter Marks of The Washington Post says, okay, I'll go there. Stereophonic is the best play of the year. Written by David Adjmi, directed by Daniel Auchin, and featuring original music by Arcade Fire's Will Butler, the story follows an up-and-coming 1970s rock band as they gather in a California music studio to record a brand new album, but it's a bumpy ride that threatens to tear the band apart. You may find yourself being reminded of the famous recording processes for legendary bands like Led Zeppelin, Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, and Fleetwood Mac. So get your tickets now and see Stereophonic live on Broadway this spring. Visit stereophonicplay.com/vox for more info.
This week on The Gray Area, writer Derek Thompson makes his case that everything has become a cult. Well, almost everything.
Is Taylor Swift the closest thing we have to a mass cult today?
No, I think she's the closest thing we have to Christianity. It's me.
Find out if you're in a cult this week on The Gray Area, wherever you get your podcasts.
You took part last year, or maybe the writing was the year before, in one of the most just spectacular songs of the year, which was Make Me Feel by Janelle Monáe.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Baby, don't make me spell it out for you. All of the feelings that I got for you can't be explained, but I can try for you.
Even just from a sonic textural point of view, it sounded so different, but obviously it had an extremely powerful and sort of potently queer message within it, within the song. There's this fantastic moment where she sings about being a sexual bender, and that moment she bends her voice through the entire scale. I think she walks down the scale in ways which are not actually in a 12-tone scale.
Yeah. Tender and emotional, sexual bender, mess me up, yeah, but no one does it better. There's nothing better. That's just the way you make me feel.
There's some microtones.
That's the Julia Michaels special. I can't take credit for that. But what's funny is which is why music is so fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Is that to us? It's she's on a sexual bender. Like, right. Not a sexual, not like she's bending sexuality. Like, she's like when you go on a bender for the weekend and you drink too much. And to us, it was that version of a bender.
Wow. Huh.
But the majority of listeners hear it as a like sexual, which to me is
gender bending.
It's fucking amazing.
Yeah. I mean, that's like such a good example of what you're talking about, too, where you can have these songs that can be mega hits and that people can sing along to the chorus and not necessarily think about, you know, its meaning. But then in other ways, it people can take that material and reinterpret it and inscribe their own meaning.
Yeah.
Make collectives around that.
Yeah.
You also worked on Bad at Love.
Yes.
With Halsey, which also has a story of lovers of multiple genders.
Yeah. Got a girl with California eyes, and I thought that she could really be the one this time, but I never got the chance to make a mind because she fell in love with little thin white lines. London girl with her attitude, we never told no one, but we look so cute. Both got way better things to do, but I always think about it when I'm riding through. I believe that I'm in 2D. Another great example of sharing your activism within your music. Well, and again, it's just the goal to be honest.
Yeah.
Right.
And hopefully one day being honest about Halsey being, and I can say bisexual for Halsey because she definitely identifies as bisexual, shouldn't be viewed as activism. It should just be viewed as I'm telling you my fucking story.
Right.
But it makes me very proud that, you know, that song, I think it went to number two on pop radio. Like, that's a pretty amazing moment for queer kids to hear. You know, I say all the time when, you know, pronouns are so important, because the first time I ever heard someone use a same-sex pronoun in a song was Ani DiFranco.
Tell you the truth, I prefer the worst to you. Too bad you had a half, a better half. She's not really my type, but I think you two are forever. And I hate to say it, but you're perfect together, so fuck you. And your untouchable face, fuck you. For existing in the first place, and who am I that I should be lying for your touch? Say, who am I? I bet you can't even tell me that much. And imagine if Ani DiFranco was on the radio, because it changed my life. Right. It saved my life. It created a community for me and my friends to, you know, all obsess over Ani together. Yeah. My favorite memories as a teenager all revolve around Ani DiFranco. And I think that it's sometimes very hard for straight people to understand why it is so powerful, because to them it's just, oh, well, it's just a song. Like, who cares if he said he or she? And it's like, but every song has been for you. Right.
Yeah.
And I, of course, love the amazing straight artists in the world and the straight songwriters, and I can listen to their songs and relate to them and connect to them. And I think it's time that straight people listen to our songs with our pronouns and they connect to them as well. And so for Halsey to prove that that is possible. And what's even crazier is most people didn't even notice.
That is crazy.
That is what's so funny, is that, like, everyone's so terrified. And yet, like, Halsey did it. It was a huge fucking hit. At the time, it was her biggest hit that she had. Obviously, now the current song blew us out of the water. But but Amy Allen's fierce, and Halsey's one of the best writers in the world. But yeah, it's like nobody cares.
We're sort of talking broadly about more top 40 and sort of music on the Billboard within pop, because obviously there's people making music from a queer perspective that are not represented in the top 40. But I'm curious, are you hearing anybody bringing in non-binary pronouns into pop music?
I mean, it's coming.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been fortunate enough to work on almost all of the B. Miller album that's coming. And everyone be very prepared. It's one of my favorite things I've ever been a part of. It's fucking nuts. And we say some shit on there. I think we do use they, them, and theirs at some point in the song. But we say other crazy shit to where we even call ourselves out. Like, I want to... Never mind, I can't give it away yet. But what am I doing? I almost did that. And there's another really big artist that I've been working with a lot, have and working with currently.
Yeah.
Who we 100% use a they, them, and theirs in it. But I can't give away who that is.
Cool. It'll be
even more exciting when it just happens.
Yeah.
But we're basically saying, like, 2019 is a is a powerful year that we're going to hear some music.
We're going to hear some shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
Do we want to do a little Classical Masters, or should we keep...
What is Classical
keep
Masters?
Keep barreling ahead.
I want to know what that is. That sounds great.
I guess we have to do it then.
Yeah, we have to do it.
Okay, so let's set the scene. It's the late 1700s. You're Franz Joseph Haydn, the great classical composer, and you're in the employ of the Prince of Esterhazy. So you're like a member of his royal court, and you're basically there to like supply symphonies on demand. And it's been a long time that you've been at the prince's like kind of rural court away from the city, and your musicians are starting to get like really anxious. They miss their wives, frankly. Yeah. They're like, we've been here way too long. We got to go home and see our families. So Haydn is, I mean, clearly he and the prince have a close relationship, because he basically writes this kind of like a protest symphony,
really,
which is very unique in the classical repertoire. So if we just listen to the very end of the symphony, this is what the prince would have heard and seen. He would have heard one by one the instruments of the orchestra take a solo. So right here we can hear the French horn taking a solo. And now the symphony continues, but what the prince would have seen is the French hornist would have finished that solo, blown out the candle that was illuminating his music stand, stand up,
and walk away.
And walk out.
Dope!
And one by one, the other musicians do this. They take a solo, they blow out their candle, and then they,
oh my
and
God,
then they walk
I love
off.
It.
And that's why the symphony number 45 is called the Farewell Symphony. And it's why the next day the prince sent the entire orchestra home to hang out with their families.
I love that.
A little labor protest.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
a little organized
awesome.
Labor protest. So I guess all to say that, you know, from Haydn's Farewell Symphony to Swan Song, you know, musicians have been finding ways to put subtle messages of protest and of liberation into their music.
I'm so glad we did that. That was amazing.
And what do we have next, Charles?
I recently met with this really wonderful songwriter named Dee Orchada, who is non-binary and Latinx from a duo called FBGM out of Boston. And they make music which they describe as both genderless and genreless.
Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Which is really fascinating. And one thing that Dee told me about that I never really realized is how every single night when they perform, they need to make the conscious choice of whether or not it's safe to come out to the audience.
Yeah.
And I was curious from your perspective, what kind of additional steps need to be taken in the music industry to make it safe for queer performers and performers of all identities?
There's a couple layers there because, like, in the touring space, the music business, meaning basically everyone that works out here in LA, there's nothing they can really do. That's more of a venue space. That's more of a cultural space. You know, a whole lot has to change. You know, in my old band, So Many Precious Weapons, you know, I was living my life, you know, I do identify as gender nonconforming, and I was very visually living that truth in for many, many, many years. I mean, I still do live that truth, but like I looked crazy, full makeup, you know, and crazy, amazing, full makeup, 5 o'clock shadow, 6-inch heels, like all day, every day. And so, you know, touring and traveling, it's tough. You know, if we were in a city where it was, we could actually sell the room and there was a lot of people, I always felt safe.
Yeah.
But we have stories of, I mean, crazy shit of during shows of people threatening me during shows. Oh, even in like some bar in Vegas, it happened once, you know, and it happened a lot in the South. I lived in New York, every day was facing verbal violence. And a couple days a month, there was a, you know, a actual physical violence or a threat of physical violence. And so that's a hard question because it's just, it's so much has to just do with culture and society that makes it unsafe as a touring performing musician. Yeah. But then when it comes to the actual business, I think it's just about labels not being afraid to sign people that are living very different, what they view as different lives. And it's tough though, because there is the endless question in music is like, but who's going to relate to them? And that's just the dumbest question ever, because
good stories are
everybody
relatable.
Everybody is. Good stories are relatable. And so it's a tough thing because it's a very, very passive homophobia, transphobia, femphobia, however we want to, queer phobia, however you want, whatever phobia we want to use. It's very passive because you'll have executives who are extremely open-minded, who have many queer people in their lives. But when it comes to signing that, then they go, oh, fuck, I don't really know. Is it going to work? Is it going to blow? Is it going to... And the advice I always give is that, you know, it's not just when it comes to diverse people. It comes to any musician right now. Like, because people can make so much noise for themselves on the internet, it's very rare that someone's going to sign someone who just, like, doesn't exist.
Right.
Artistically, creatively.
Right.
And so for queer people, people of color, any sort of marginalized people, like, it's the only advice that I can give to them is make as much noise as you can on your own. And then labels will be desperate to sign you because it's a business. It's money. Yeah. And so labels are already looking at white, straight male artists that way of like, but what are they doing?
Yeah.
What have they done on their own? That's already happening
there.
So of course it's going to happen way more for marginalized people, which is unfair. And it's fucked and it shouldn't be that way. But that's the only way we're going to win this battle.
One thing I really admire about your work is you do a lot to boost up and coming performers. And
I try my hardest. It's fucking hard though.
Yeah. And one thing you're doing is you're launching a new label.
Correct.
Called Facet.
Yes.
Will you say a little bit about what some of your intentions are with that label? And
I've already signed a couple people before this like official company was formed. So yeah. I have Shea Diamond, we partnered with Asylum. Yeah. She's a trans woman of color who has amazing story. Yeah. Thank you. She's, I mean, I can't take credit for her, but I'm thank you for appreciating her. Her voice is insane. Her songwriting's insane. And then West Period, we partnered with Interscope on that. Mm-hmm. But now with this official company, my publisher, Katie Vinton, and I decided to like live our dream, live our truth, and start a company together. And, you know, a lot of songwriters and producers after success will start imprints or start labels. And
right.
if I was going to do it, I wanted to really fucking do it.
Mm. Yeah.
And so I need someone to... who knows how to run a business.
And she's a star.
And she, you know, Katie's one of the best there is. And, you know, she's the only reason I have this whole career. You know, when the band started to fizzle out, nobody fucking cared about me. She's the one that made all this happen for me. And so we can't announce who we're signing yet to that new venture, but it's really exciting. And our goal is to just... it's all based on fucking talent.
Yeah.
And the people that we are signing are not... typical signings at all.
Yeah.
You know, whether they're, you know, they're not 19 or whether or whether they're marginalized or divert, like we're
Justin, are you saying that I have a chance?
You be that every time I say that everyone's like, oh, so I get to be a pop star now? I'm like, no. But yeah, we, you know, it's just to lead with music first, songs first. We're song people, you know? And I, of course, want people with crazy fucking visuals who push all these boundaries, but like, it's got to start with the songs for us because she came from publishing. I'm a pop songwriter.
Yeah.
So I wish I could tell you more juicy details, but it's coming. The information's coming.
This is great. The suspense is even better.
Yeah. A lot of what I'm taking away from our conversation together is that you describe yourself on Twitter as a songwriter and an activist.
Yeah.
And for me, those things just collapse together in just good storytelling. That what I'm hearing consistently is that your job is to get stories out of other people, to create spaces for people to be able to tell their story, whatever that story might be, without censorship. And I think that's a beautiful message to be sharing.
Well, thank you.
Before we go,
yeah.
one of the things that we do for a lot of our episodes is put together a playlist of things related to the episode. So we actually worked with that artist, Dior Chado, who I was mentioning from FBGM, who helped seed a playlist of artists who are helping queer pop music. I wanted to see if there were any particular artists within that realm that you wanted to shout out to add to that playlist.
Well, Shea Diamond, of course.
Definitely, yeah.
I'm trying to... of course, my mind goes blank in this moment when all I do all day on Twitter is just talk about queer artists. Vincent is amazing queer man of color who is, I think, the greatest, one of the greatest singers alive.
Any song you wanted to shout out?
Remember Me, the vocal on that is fucking insane.
Yeah.
I think he's one of those people that he's like, you know, 2 seconds from cracking his own code and will just take over. It's like Whitney Houston level singing.
Wow.
Where like technically it's crazy and then the emotion is there. Because a lot of times, like the music theory question, if the singing is too technical, it doesn't have the emotion, and he's one of those amazing voices that can do that. Yeah, that's another great queer person, and a queer person of color, which we need much more of in the music business.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me. This was so fun.
So much fun. Yeah. I learned a lot.
What did you learn? Let's review this.
Scream on the two of the chorus. Patty Larkin, best text painter in the business.
I told him the dog wouldn't run is maybe the best example of it.
And music theory is great, but don't let it get in the way.
There you go.
Yeah.
What did you learn?
Tell a good story.
What did you? Okay, Charlie.
Well, I love this. You get to be the honorary professor.
Yeah, I'm loving it.
The main thing for me is realizing how a song needs to subvert. Ego subversion is essential to great songwriting, and yet there's this, at the same time, you need to tell your story.
Yeah.
And so there's this need to figure out, how do you serve the idea, that song, which might come from yourself, but not force too much of yourself into the song at the same time, which might be, hey, I don't want, like...
Well, protest in the verse... sing along in the chorus.
Yeah, right? Totally. And like, but like, so much of my early songwriting was, can I get like 17 chords in this thing? And how's it going to work? And I thought it was really exciting. And nobody cares.
I was the worst. I was like, I'll never just play like a major chord. Like, if you, you can find a couple songs on YouTube of like my early solo albums. Which was just me in college. It's like, why? Why? Like, not everything has to be a fucking sus, blah, blah, blah. I was like obsessed with sus too forever. That's all I would play.
I'm working with some folks right now on an album. It's just the most talented keyboardist I know.
Yeah.
So talented. One of the hard things when you get really good at your trade is you can lose the layperson's reference to the thing that you're doing.
Yep.
So you can be like, I'm just going to do a progressive house reggae trap song, and unless like all those things are happening in popular consciousness and like they happen to work together, it's really easy for someone who just has studied everything to voraciously throw in references.
It's true.
But then it has no actual there for average listeners.
100%. And I think it's just like, you know, if you're making music for musicians, that's a problem.
Right.
That's when the shit gets in the way.
Yeah.
If only someone with a degree in music can understand what you're doing. That's not, I mean, good for you, hallelujah, but like, I don't want to hear it.
Thank you, Justin.
Of course, thank you.
So much fun. We are super excited to announce that Switched on Pop is now a production of the Vox Media Podcast Network.
Woo!
Woo! So now we've got some new people that we get to shout out, which is really exciting. So Switched on Pop is now executive produced by Nishat Kurwa and Allison Rocky, production by Jillian Weinberger, engineering by Brandon McFarland. Our community manager is Sarah Terry, and I want to say thank you to Curtis Chan and thanks to D Orchada. You can check out their music at fbgmtheband.com, and you can find their playlist on Queering Pop Music in our show notes.
You can find us on Twitter and Instagram still at Switched on Pop, and you can send us your thoughts and recommendations there.
We are also very excited to announce that we'll be taking the show weekly, which means that we will see you again in a week.
There we go.
And until then,
thanks for listening.
Support for Switched on Pop comes from Stereophonic, Broadway's must experience new play. If you only see one thing on Broadway this year, make sure it's Stereophonic, written by David Adjmi, directed by Daniel Auchin, and featuring original music by Arcade Fire's Will Butler. The play follows a 1970s rock band on the verge of breaking down, breaking up, or breaking through. The New York Times, The New Yorker, and New York Magazine call it best of the year, and Peter Marks of the Washington Post says, okay, I'll go there. Stereophonic is the best play of the year. Get your tickets at stereophonicplay.com/Vox.